This is KHOL News. I'm Robin Vincent. For years, Jackson's housing crisis has unraveled the fabric of the community. A lack of affordable housing here has long prompted the departure of working class folks, young professionals, and families, just to name a few. As the November election nears, local candidates are facing scrutiny about how they intend to address this unending problem. On Wednesday, candidates for mayor, town council, and county commission participated in a forum hosted by housing advocacy group Shelter JH and Act Now JH. That's an activist group that wants to redirect funding from policing and use it for things like housing. One illuminating question centered on housing insecurity. That's something many Jackson residents have faced. But have the candidates experienced it? Of the town council candidates, many had interesting housing tales. Mayor Pete Muldoon's experience sounded most familiar to working class folks and those of us who still struggle to find stable housing.
I have lived, I think, in 17 different places in Jackson in the 20 years I've been here. That's not counting the many places that I lived in my RV on the 3-4 summers that I lived in a camper after becoming homeless during the recession. I recently bought a property in Michigan because I've never owned a house here in Teton County, and I'm frankly thinking that I will not ever be able to own one. And I don't want to be old and living in a rental unit. For somebody to say, hey, you can just get an extra job and you can buy a house here, it's ludicrous. I've got 3 jobs. I mean, I literally just walked off of a job site where I'm building a house that is going to be workforce housing for a friend that I could never afford. He got a bid on that and it was $500,000 for a 500 square foot ARU. So getting another job here really isn't in the cards for me. 3 is enough. I think that we can do better. We've heard a lot about, well, we just have to find a plan. Well, the plan is we have to go build it. And then we don't have the money, so we've got to go raise the money.
The money, Muldoon says, will come from the 7th cent of sales tax. That is, if voters approve it on the November ballot. The other 3 candidates for town council pointed to personal experiences with family members that shaped their housing situations. Devin Veeman revealed how hardships in her life affected her housing and spurred creative measures.
My husband and I were able to build a home because his family took advantage of the family homestead exemption. So we were blessed in that way, but we gave a contractor a huge deposit that was all a loan at the time, and he actually went to Las Vegas with it and used it on all sorts of things. So there I was, 26 years old, brand new baby, a hole in the ground that had framing and had just lost $250,000.
The adversity didn't end there, Veeman says. She ended up getting a divorce and found herself living life as a single mother.
And then so being a single mom living in town, I looked for a place that I felt comfortable and safe for my child. Cottonwood Flats had just been built at that time, so I ended up renting there. And for several years, I lived there in somebody else's guest house because I just wanted a sense of family around me. Fast forward to I ended up getting remarried to somebody that I went to high school with. And what we did was we saved up our money for years and we did a remodel on the house that I actually grew up in. So we live with my dad. My mom actually passed away 6 years ago and we found out that he was not really eating dinner unless I cooked it for him. We took advantage of the ARU that you're allowed to have. He has a 1,000 square foot apartment with his own entrance above the garage. And we live downstairs. So I think generational living is something that we need to become accustomed to here.
Jim Rooks, meanwhile, referenced a narrative that many longtime residents espouse, and that is that it's always been hard to find housing in Jackson.
Let's see, I moved out of my house when I was a sophomore in high school via a joint agreement between my father and I. I lived on a tent down on the Snake River, didn't even have a van down on the river, had to live in a tent. I've lived in pop-up campers. I've lived in backyards. We consider ourselves the litmus test because you think with like 5 generations of family history in Jackson, it would have been easy, and it never has been. What we did is I moved. I worked for 8 years out of the community, moved back in 2002 to help care for my parents. And my wife and I bought a condo in town, just barely, improved it, sold it. And we bought a lot and we spent 3 years serving as general construction managers of our own project, building our own house. So I love that story. I'm proud of that story. But people are right that can't happen anymore. We cannot just you can't work yourself out of this. But I also don't think you can just tax your way out of it. I support the seventh penny tax allocated to housing, but we have to join with private sectors. The Gill and the Lockharts are outstanding opportunities for us to look at. Those proposals were not perfect.
But no proposal, Rook says, is perfect. For her part, Jessica Sell Chambers says she is among the minority. She bought a home in Jackson with inheritance money after her mother's death.
We actually own my house with my little brother. So I am very cognizant of my privilege and I hate to say luck, because obviously losing your mother isn't luck. But this was one thing that came along with that tragedy. But I know that I would never be able to have a home here if it weren't for that piece of money to invest in. And like I said, we invested with my brother in addition. I think about if we had to sell this home for whatever reason or part ways with my brother, I don't know that we would have enough money to buy back into the community as it stands.
Chambers says her intimate knowledge of how the housing crisis has affected community members inspired her to use some of her own home to help.
We've housed a family in our ground level. So we've essentially split our home in two, and we had a mother and her two sons come and live with us whenever the Virginian was closed and kicked them out. And we've finished an apartment fully so that we can house other people more permanently.
Candidates also answered questions about how racism has long been baked into America's housing policies, and they gave their take on housing mitigation rates. Those require developers to pay for a significant portion of employee housing, and they're integral to this area's affordable housing program. Stay tuned for more KHOL coverage from this candidate forum. We'll take a deeper look at the stance of town council candidates, and we'll examine responses from mayoral and county commission hopefuls. Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, congestion in Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Parks has irked a lot of residents. KHOL reported in August that residents are primarily concerned about health and safety. They worry about the influx of visitors from coronavirus hotspots. The impact heavy visitation is having on the land has also been a concern for folks. And that's why this next story offers a little levity. It's about an artist who was inspired by displeased visitors to America's national parks. The online reviews posted by such visitors became the fodder for a series called Subpar Parks. Notably, the reviews were posted before the pandemic, but it's likely that with all the crowds this summer, more such reviews are imminent. Daniel Reisel of KSJD in Cortez, Colorado, reports.
Across southeast Utah, red and orange rock fills a sandstone landscape with rivers meeting among the canyons.
It's almost embarrassingly scenic.
Karen Garthwaite is an interpretive specialist at Canyonlands and Arches National Parks. The latter is home to more than 2,000 natural arches.
These features pop up at you in the foreground, commanding your attention.
That includes the 46-foot-tall Delicate Arch, a symbol not only for the park, but also for Utah, depicted on many of its license plates. But seeing it in person didn't wow one visitor, who left a disappointed online review, saying the arch looks nothing like its car counterpart. And that review caught the eye of North Carolina-based illustrator Amber Scher.
It was kind of like a bolt of lightning.
In late 2019, Scher was looking for a project to reignite her love for illustration. Inspired by a post on Reddit, she found one-star reviews had been written for every national park. The review for Arches turned into her first poster in a series she calls Subpar Parks.
For the Badlands, the review was, "The only thing bad about these lands is the entire experience." It's one of those things where you know they're mad about it and they're in the shower later and they come up with just like the best zinger that they have to put out there. That's really what it felt like reading that one.
Scher's poster for Mesa Verde National Park places a cliff dwelling, one of the thousands of ancestral Puebloan sites within the park, against its review, saying there's, quote, "not much to look at." A review for Hawaii Volcanoes National Park lamented not being able to touch lava.
Touching molten lava is something that Hawaii Volcanoes National Park actively discourages.
Jessica Farrakane is the public affairs specialist for the park.
And it's not only dangerous to touch molten lava, and that's considered very disrespectful in Native Hawaiian culture to poke or prod flowing lava.
The island itself is made of lava, so Farrakane argues the park's 300,000-some acres should make for plenty of lava touching. As the Hawaii Volcano's social media accounts shared its poster and interacted with others from subpar parks, Farrakane noticed people rallying around the park by sharing photos of their visit. Garthwaite noticed this in Utah as well, but she understands how some visitors feel and recalls someone at a Canyonlands Visitor Center muttering under her breath.
I could hear she was saying, rocks, rocks, nothing but rocks, not even any birds. Like she was just not feeling it.
Garthwaite says she doesn't expect a park to prescribe an experience, even if she, Farrakane, and other rangers make their best efforts to prepare visitors for what parks have to offer.
And maybe it's not always awesome. And maybe these are just snarky for the fun of it. But all of it's okay.
Cher relates to the disgruntled reviews, too, and wants her project to be viewed as a commentary on how we behave online. Feeling angry sets off what she describes as a one-star review impulse in everyone.
I started talking to other people, especially people who own, you know, stores or restaurants, and they were like, your project helps me so much because it just makes me realize that no matter what I bring to the table, someone is going to be upset.
Since its launch, Subpar Parks has drawn more than 240,000 followers on Instagram. The success of poster sales has allowed Cher to transition out of a full-time job in March. Gift shops in towns near national parks, including Glacier and Joshua Tree, want to carry her work too. Next, she plans to go international, including Canada's public lands.
I know there are not great reviews about their parks, too, because this is not a uniquely American thing.
And maybe someday she can revisit her favorite national park.
It's such a crazy place. It's so much more than it looks like from the rim.
If you had to write a one-star review yourself for Grand Canyon National Park, what would it say?
I think it would say, there's just too much to look at.
For KSJD, I'm Daniel Reisel.
And this is K2L News.